It's 6ish on Sunday night. Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX935. Tonight, my show is titled Becoming a Certain Kind of Person, and it's part two, if you want, from my show on the philosophy of love that I did recently, based on a philosophy course I did at Oxford this summer. Before I get too deeply into it, I'm going to quote from a recent article in the Times by a professor of psychology at Northwestern University called Eli Finkel, and it talks a little about how the best marriages work, because becoming the sort of person you want to be can either be a product of a good marriage to a good person, or it can confuse that marriage if you're going to decide to change. If you're going to decide to change, you kind of need to know that your partner is endorsing this and going to help you. And it's not going to be that easy, because some conflict will emerge. Either they won't want you to change from, say, somebody they could boss around, or they may be a little harsh in their methods, albeit with your encouragement, because you've opened the door for criticism, expressed criticism, where it might not have been opened before. What we all want of our chosen partner is to feel valued as the best person they could possibly have secured for themselves. But what, according to this article, we're requiring of them is to spur us on to become, as Tom Cruise's character in Jerry Maguire puts it, the me I'd always wanted to be. We still, of course, want to be appreciated for the person we currently are. But in order to help us, our partner also has to emphasize what discrepancies lie between who we are now and who we want to be, and that means pointing out our faults. Until about a century and a half ago, we would never have required such a thing of our spouses. Wives were supposed to cook and keep house and care for the children. Husbands were supposed to go out and work and pay for it all. And if there was love and support for each other along the way, that was sort of a luxury. Of course, times have changed considerably. Some marriages can manage a complete exchange of all of those things so they each serve in either capacity at any given point. But that's ideal, and it requires occasionally using some aggressive methods to push each other to take on different roles in order to meld the person you are with the person you'd ideally like to be. And as in any pursuit of self-actualization, you might have to trade some current contentment for a little future contention and frustration and humiliation. This article quotes a married couple, Katinka Hosszú and Shane Tussup, the former a Hungarian swimmer who underperformed in the 2012 Olympics and went home without a medal. At the time, Shane Tussup was Katinka Hosszú's boyfriend. Then he became her coach, and he was ferocious and uncompromising, even inappropriately so, possibly. He'd publicly upbraid her for subpar performances. He'd sometimes throw objects or kick a wall to underscore his disappointment. But in the 2016 Olympics, Katinka won 3 golds and a silver, and largely credits Shane Tussup's demanding tactics for her success. So maybe this couple's experience is an extreme case. I mean, we're not all Olympic champions, with our partners being our coaches. But any time a partner attempts to help their loved one become something else, it's going to require a lot of criticism, more so than warmth and comfort. You can't really give complacency-shattering feedback while simultaneously making someone feel valued, loved, and sexy. Going back to the Jerry Maguire situation, when Renee Zellweger's character pushes Jerry Maguire to excel, she says rather harshly, "Don't make a joke of your life." So, in our efforts to become the person we want to be, which is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, we have 2 options. And really, we can only ask our partner to play 1 of 2 roles. They can either do the making us feel loved, valued, and comforted for who we currently are, or they can make us motivated to grow into the person we've always wanted to be. And it's up to us whether we choose the comfortable route versus the more ambitious and potentially fraught one. After all, if we're lucky, we can leave our spouse to be the former and somebody else that loves us and is close to us to be the taskmaster. But we might not have two such committed relationships. We might only have the one, which limits us to the spouse's everything model. And if that's the case, we can still go ahead, but we have to have our eyes wide open, because this requires of our partner that they continually recalibrate our behavior and maybe adopt tough love if the situation requires it, rather than tenderness. In the Jerry Maguire example, when the Renee Zellweger character says harshly, "Don't make a joke of your life," she follows it up with a warm-hearted reminder that he has the core values and facility to live up to his requirements of himself. And when we know something is expected of us like that, from somebody that really truly cares about us, we don't want to disappoint, so motivation is high. But not for the weak of spirit and will. In one way, the spouse's everything ideal is one reason that the average marriage has been getting a bit less satisfying in the recent decades. But we can also do it these days, this kind of ideal cooperative marriage, where we didn't necessarily have the opportunity or even the ideal of doing it before.
A horse and carriage, this I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Try to separate them, it's an illusion. Try, and you will only come to this conclusion. Love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. Dad was told by mother, you can't have one, you can't have none, you can't have one without the other. Try to separate them, it's an illusion. Try, and you will only come to this conclusion. Love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage. Dad was told by mother, you can't have one, you can't have one without the other.
That was my favorite song as a child. You're tuned to KX935, Laguna's one and only public FM radio station. This is the Sharon Hour, and I'm Sharon James, with the topic of tonight's show being becoming the person you want to be. And if we can become the person we want to be with the support of a partner, what better way to live one's life than that? I don't know about you, listener, but I in my life have left relationships where I felt I was required to be the kind of person I didn't quite approve of. The relationships that are most satisfying are the ones that encourage us to become the best person we can be, not the lesser or even sometimes the worst. Here's another Times article by Gregory Mankiw, an economics professor at Harvard. And you might think that economics and applied mathematics go hand in hand, but in academia, more often, economics and moral and political philosophy go together. Because we can only improve the world, economically or otherwise, if we understand how it works. He says the course he offers at Harvard is a slightly subversive one because it's to help his students understand and even appreciate the perspectives of those with whom they vehemently disagree. And at this time in our political history, it seems to be a very valid course. He says he runs it more like a book club because every week he has his students read a book by an economist that's aimed at a general audience rather than a polarized one. The books always represent a wide range of views, and the object is to wrestle with each author's ideas, which ones are dubious and which ones are persuasive, and force us to rethink our preconceptions. The books he lists are Robert Heilbronner's The Worldly Philosophers, The Lives, Times, and Ideas of the Great Economic Thinkers. Heilbronner taught at the New School before he died. Another is Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. Milton Friedman, of course, was a great defender of libertarianism and a professor at the University of Chicago. Even those who disagreed with him appreciated both the force and clarity of his arguments. Another book that discusses economic inequality and how to judge fairness in society is Equality and Efficiency, The Big Trade-Off, by Arthur M. Oaken. He came from the Brookings Institution and advised President Lyndon Johnson. Then there's Thomas Piketty's book, The Economics of Inequality, and in the perspective of the right, a book called Fair Play, What Your Child Can Teach You About Economics, Values, and the Meaning of Life, by Rochester University's economist Stephen E. Landsberg, who suggests that the values we learn on the playground can inform society's broader conceptions of equity. And he mentions various other books that discuss behavioral economics with a psychological bent to them. He says his courses have about 10 times as many applicants as he can take, which attests to the popularity of book clubs. And he says he makes sure to mix together an equal number of men and women because the economics profession has historically been a somewhat toxic environment for women. He says he also aims for political balance between the left, i.e. the liberal progressive element, dedicated to more active government, and the right, conservative or more libertarian bent that wants more limited government interference. He says he knows from experience what happens at the beginning of the course. Usually during the first term of college, students are especially open to new ideas and new friends. And he sees friendship cementing among students with opposing points of view, and that the tolerance and comity they learn from those friendships can last a lifetime and end up making the world a better place. So in our own microcosmic worlds, we can do the same. We can find friends with whom we disagree and share what we've learnt from books and form our own little book clubs that explore any particular subject from different perspectives and grow and change from that.
I read a lot nowadays, much more than before you left me high and dry in a loveless land with nothing but time on my hand. I read a lot, not just magazines, but other more serious things to get me through the day, nighttime too, whilst wondering how in the world to go on without you. Long blue. reason, describe it somehow. I read a lot, I can't put it down, while others are painting the town, you'll find me in a world of fantasy. Population 1, that's me. So if you ask me how I stopped contemplating what I now have not, I'll reply, I read a lot.
Well, reading, not for loneliness, but for knowledge, is what I'm endorsing here on tonight's Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, where tonight's topic is becoming the person you want to be. And although I'm not usually prescriptive, it's time now to offer some methods for that, gleaned from a philosophy course I recently took at Oxford University. It was called Philosophy of Love, and I shared a lot of that specific information on a show I did very recently. But tonight I'm focusing on the aspects of that course that taught you how to become the person you've always wanted to be. And there are some prescriptive ways. Speaking of books, the female philosopher Susan Wolf cites the novelist Iris Murdoch regarding the concept of changing your attitude in terms of preconceptions, and that seems a useful trait to adopt if you're going to become the person you want to be. Here's her example. A mother, whom I shall call M, feels hostility to her daughter-in-law, whom I shall call D. M finds D quite a good-hearted girl, but while not exactly common, certainly unpolished and lacking in dignity and refinement. D is inclined to be pert and familiar, insufficiently ceremonious, brusque and sometimes positively rude, and always tiresomely juvenile. M doesn't like D's accent or the way D dresses. M feels very much that her son has married beneath him. But we're invited to assume for the moment that the mother, being a very correct person, behaves beautifully to the girl throughout and never allows her real opinion to show. Those, nevertheless, are M's feelings about D. But time passes, and let's say M settles down with a hardened sense of grievance and a fixed, immutable picture of D. But we can also predict that M, being an intelligent and well-intentioned person who's capable of self-criticism, capable of giving careful attention to any occasion or object that confronts her, will talk to herself and tell herself, I'm old-fashioned and conventional, and possibly prejudiced and narrow-minded, and possibly snobbish, and certainly jealous. Let me take another look at this situation. And when she does, M observes D, reflects deliberately about D, until gradually her vision of D alters. She discovers D to not be vulgar, but refreshingly simple. Not undignified, but spontaneous. Not noisy, but fun and joyful. Not tiresomely juvenile, but delightfully youthful, etc. The philosopher Susan Wolf rejects three possible interpretations of what this example shows. The first being that loving attention is blind to a person's faults, that when there's no clear truth of the matter, loving attention chooses a positive interpretation. And three, that loving attention focuses on a person's positive qualities. Wolf argues that actually loving attention isn't blind to a person's faults. It's a matter of seeing things more clearly, or as they really are. She says there can't be careful loving attention in the absence of love, and that love provides the motivation to make the effort to see an object clearly versus through a distorting lens of self-interest. So for Susan Wolf and Iris Murdoch, adopting an attitude of love means being interested in everything about another person without necessarily loving everything about them. It means love is contrary to self-absorption, and a philosophy of love is a philosophy of objectivity, making others and the interests of others as important as those of your own. So we can learn as much from novels as books of economics in terms of how we can become a better person. Becoming a certain kind of person, a better person, is the topic of tonight's KX935's Share an Hour. And as I mentioned in my last show on philosophy, you can't really pretend to be somebody you're not, because it doesn't work. You know, you try to be empathetic and caring to the friend that's depressed, and you don't feel it, and they feel that you don't feel it, and it doesn't really help anybody. So what are you to do? Well, you actually have to change what my philosophy teacher called your worldview. You might call it your attitude, but really it's a bigger thing than that. It's really how you see the world and how you want to maybe affect the world personally. So on the one hand, you have your worldview, and next you have to consider what options you have for promoting that worldview in any given situation. And then you have the various criteria you employ to choose between those options. And the hope is that if you can narrow those criteria down, then you don't have to be constantly weighing this and that. You can apply a single criterion to guide you in almost any circumstance, so that eventually there's a straight line in most situations for promoting your worldview. And when you think about worldview, I don't know if you know about Wittgenstein's duck rabbit. It's kind of a visual, so I can't really describe it terribly well here on the radio. But it's basically one drawing, one little sketch, and you could sort of draw it for yourself to see what I'm talking about. People look at it on the one hand, from the one perspective, they see the beak of what looks like a duck, and other people see that beak as the ear of a rabbit. So what it really proves is that our worldview is shaped by our experience, and we're quick to jump to one analysis or another because of our experience. And by the way, experience has three components. Sensation, the sensation of what the lines and the curves on a page do for you. Two, concept. I see the duck or the rabbit. I see certain features of something familiar. And three, criterion, which is the combination of sensation and concept that will inform how it can be described to others, whether as a duck or a rabbit. So we do have a choice. We have a choice to experience the drawing as a duck or a rabbit, and we have a choice as to which criteria we use to adopt our worldview. Science doesn't come into that. Science doesn't have an equation for our options the way ethics does. But scientific understanding can help us find patterns in things. And the more we know, the more we explore those patterns, the more able we are to sort through our options sensibly with an informed point of view. I mean, at one point we all thought the world was flat, and so we saw our options being to sail straight ahead and at some point, I guess, fall off the edge of the world. But once we saw the world as spherical, then we could see that we could just keep travelling and eventually return to where we came from. So we constantly have a chance to revise our theories by gaining knowledge, revise our worldview and the criteria that go into selecting one when our knowledge is advanced. For instance, Newton came along with his theory, and for those of us paying attention, forced us to adopt a different scientific view. And then Einstein came along and bettered Newton's theory with his theory of relativity. So it's not like our worldview has to stay set in stone. Once we better educate ourselves and know more about the world and explore more, we can modify our worldview as we go along to the betterment of everybody. Ignorance may be bliss, but it doesn't help you become a better person. And becoming the person you want to be is the topic of my Share an Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on this Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX93.5. Our attitude toward the world obviously colours our worldview, and whether we see it as a beautiful, wonderful, lovable place or a scary, dangerous place where misery and indignity lie at every turn. Our attitude is going to colour our thinking as to whether we see the world as a scary duck or a lovable rabbit. But if we adopt the worldview that human nature is basically decent versus basically evil, that will help us in pushing the world towards its more beautiful, lovable aspects in our everyday thoughts and actions. Even when it's coloured by some private experiences that aren't so fine, even improving your scientific understanding of the world can help how you personally look at the world. For instance, it's not unrealistic to suggest that most spiders in North America aren't going to kill you. So it's not realistic or necessary to be as afraid of them as it might be if you were living somewhere where there were an abundance of killer spiders. Similarly, your perspective on the world and yourself is going to be very different if you just see the Earth as a tiny component, a planet moving through space, rather than something fixed and solitary sitting at the centre of the universe. So, acknowledging that if we want to become a certain kind of person, we need to adopt a worldview on which we can base all our future ideas, thoughts, and actions, and that we need to establish criteria for that worldview. What is your criterion going to be, listener? You could say, I'm going to do everything with the worldview to making everyone happier. Or you could say, I'm going to do everything with the worldview to making all of us richer. But here we instantly have a conflict because the richer criterion involves competitive goods. The happier criterion involves shared goods. Let me explain. A shared good is something that isn't a zero-sum concept. It potentially can include everyone without competition. So let's consider for a moment that it's possible that a shared good is happiness, because it is possible to make one person happy without making somebody else unhappy, whereas it's impossible to make one person rich without getting that money from somewhere, making somebody else less rich as a result. So we should try to establish a worldview if we want to be really good people, as opposed to self-serving people, which is maybe why we're even considering changing as people. We should try to establish a worldview that said, I want to do what's best for everyone, or what's best for the majority. That would be a utilitarian point of view, as espoused by Jeremy Bentham. That could also get us into trouble. But a worldview that said, I want to make the world a better place, a more beautiful place. And that definition of beautiful in the context I'm considering also means a more loving place, not just an aesthetically more beautiful place. That would be an easier proposition than approaching every incident with the worldview, I want to make myself wealthier. Then if you adopted that worldview of I wanted to make the world a better, more beautiful, more loving place, it would follow that, say, if you're angry at someone, you wouldn't be figuring out how you can get back at them. You'd be figuring how you could take a more objective stance and think about the outcome of trying to get back at someone and how that would fit in with your worldview. So having the worldview that said, I want to make the world a more loving place, would actually steer you towards an outcome that would fit with that worldview and would lead you to pursue a course of action that would best bring about a more loving place, albeit in your own little single personal way. So a good worldview is how you can best affect the causal fruition of your actions, given any situation. Some situations, of course, are going to be much more difficult. Socrates suggested, though, that we focus on the simple examples when coming up with a general philosophy. because it's necessary to learn from the simple cases, those ideals, concepts, and tools we need in order to tackle the more difficult ones. My teacher in a paper approached a more difficult one with the situation of a mugger. He said, imagine that your current worldview is to do what's best for you, earn the most money you can, gratify your desires, whatever. And your current desire is to buy a pair of new running shoes, but you don't have the money. What you have is a natural strength and fitness. And you happen to know that there's a young mother who wanders down a dark alley on the way home from work. So you think, okay, I'll mug her, then I can have the money, and I'm stronger than her, I'll get away with it. It will satisfy my worldview, which is to do what's best for me and get wealthier and get my needs met. But say you've changed your worldview and you want to do what's best for everyone. Well, then you realize that to gratify your own desires, you can't steal from a young mother because that's against her best interests. And your stealing from her is at her expense. In order to sustain a worldview that says you want to make the world a more beautiful place, you need to make every relationship within the world more beautiful, and where and when you can, shared with that other person. Clearly, it's not making the world a more beautiful place to go around mugging people and creating suffering as a result. So this becomes an all or nothing thing. And eventually, if you practice the principle of making the world a more beautiful place, you'll find yourself unable to consciously do something that is antithetical to that. Now, war brings in a whole other element, of course, but this isn't necessarily a pacifist approach. Every now and then, we do go to war, and occasionally those wars are justified, can even be ennobling. The 6th century Chinese general Sun Tzu said, "The art of war teaches us to rely not on the likelihood of the enemy not coming, but on our own readiness to receive him, not on the chance of his not attacking, but rather on the fact that we have made our position unassailable." The more contemporary General Norman Schwarzkopf says, "The more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war." The novelist Isabel Allende says, "We don't even know how strong we are until we're forced to bring that hidden strength forward. In times of tragedy, of war, of necessity, people do amazing things. The human capacity for survival and renewal is awesome." And the television journalist Darren Kagan says, "Bad things do happen in the world, like war, natural disasters, disease. But out of those situations always arise stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things." So when we do occasionally have to be more aggressive in our approach than loving in order to further our worldview, does it mean we have to partition ourselves, adopt a separate worldview for those occasions? Well, not necessarily. In the case of the mugger, we can decide that the best thing to make the world a more beautiful place is to call the police and have that guy in prison if you see him mug. And if you can effect that, you've put someone away that is in the world to do harm, and his motivations only affect the degree of harm he or she intended. You can also see that if they are disciplined, then they might learn not to do it again. The same can apply to war. It's not easy stuff, any of this. Becoming a certain kind of person is the topic of my show tonight. That's the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And it's kind of a continuation of the things I learnt during the philosophy course I took at Oxford this summer. I talked about the philosophy of love in the show I did most recently. Tonight, I'm going to talk about how adopting an apt worldview is actually the best route to becoming a better, more loving person in terms of your interactions with everybody. It can also help reduce stress. It can mean you don't have to make decisions about every individual circumstance because you can just apply your worldview to every situation and see where it takes you rather than going through endless questions and criteria for what your actions are going to be. You can have one application, one size fits all circumstance, which also helps reduce stress. And actually, without adopting your own worldview, you really reduce your free choice enormously because your brain can have a mind of its own. Have you ever lashed out at someone and surprised yourself by it, then been mortified at the result it had, the way you hurt somebody that you really hadn't meant to hurt, and yourself because you've let yourself down? Well, according to Stanford neurobiologist Robert Sapolsky, our most impulsive actions aren't always determined by the moment when they happen, but rather what happened to a person's body and brain, maybe weeks, months, even years beforehand, going all the way back to our childhood and our genetic makeup and the culture into which we were born. In this ARP article, Sapolsky talks about how biology can influence our behavior for better or worse. He says, if, for instance, you're in pain, you're more likely to jump to interpret a comment, something ambiguous, as threatening. Your hormone levels in the days before you reacted in anger and surprised yourself can also influence how you behaved in that moment days later. And then there are sometimes genetic reasons why certain individuals misinterpret an object or an action, and that excites or unnerves them. So really, the only places where we can exercise free will are in the moral areas and how we accommodate the stress factors in our lives. Because stress can make us do ridiculous, stupid things and make ridiculous decisions. They may seem like brilliant decisions at the time, but they're things that we can regret for years and years after. The frontal cortex is severely affected during times of stress, so the fight and flight syndrome is heightened. It's easier to be afraid during times of stress and not at your sharpest cognitively. Also, stress makes us less empathetic, less compassionate, less capable of taking somebody else's perspective. In other words, less kind and nice and loving to each other, which I'm going to suggest might be our most compelling reason to have a worldview that says we should try to love everybody, treat everybody with equal dignity and respect, and make modifications only if there's a compelling reason not to treat them that way. Because we all feel more stress when we feel we have no control over what's going on, when we don't know what the future is going to deliver or how long something bad is going to last. So at least if we have a worldview that we can rely on to guide us, we have a better chance at reducing that stress. And I'm going to focus tonight's KX935 Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on exploring that. We talked in my previous show about love having many forms. There's romantic love and friendship, and then there are various degrees of friendship. And sometimes when we mistake acquaintances for friends, it can influence our worldview. So we need to actually know who our true friends are and that they're not likely to disappoint us, which might reduce the pool, but we do need a good social support system to help us maintain a worldview that I'm going to suggest, where the world is as loving and beautiful a place as you can hope to make it by your worldview or attitude. You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Tonight on becoming a certain kind of person. You know, we're all born despite our free will. We're not given our own choice in it. There's always a third party involved in everybody's existence. We're always, to some extent, subject to what philosophers call moral luck. You know, things happen to us during our birth, during our childhood and adulthood and our entire lives. Maybe our parents separated and that's affected our worldview. Maybe a car ran into us and broke our leg when we were young and that's affected our worldview. Something terrible happened to us or something wonderful happened to us. But becoming the person you want to be means adopting a first-person perspective and rejecting the hand chance dealt, or at least rejecting leaving things to chance in the future. Because leaving things to chance is something you actively do. You choose to leave things to chance, or to not leave things to chance, to act on a philosophy of life you've personally chosen, to aim for a path you've personally selected. because we can't deny there's always an element of chance in life. No matter how dedicated you've been or still are to exercising control over any given situation. For instance, I don't know if you've been watching the tennis tournaments recently, but even the top most dedicated players who've devoted their lives to training their serve regularly fail to get the ball in the part of the court they're aiming for. So let's give an example of the kind of chance that happens to you rather than something that you leave to chance. In this philosophy course I just took at Oxford that I'm quoting from now on this Sharon Hour, it's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, tonight dedicated to the idea of becoming the person you would like to be from a philosophical standpoint. We could call this the part two of my Philosophy of Love program that I did very recently. My teacher suggests that we imagine that at 2 p.m. on September the 20th, you happen to be walking along a riverbank. It's just started raining. The riverbank is suddenly muddy, and you see a child slip and fall into the river. So you're now in a situation where you have two options. You can try to save the child or not. That's the actual physical environment. Now there's your personal physical being. Let's imagine that in your early teens, though your bicycle brakes failed at the T-junction, there happened not to be any traffic. So you're fine now. Everything's fine with your body. You're able to run to get the life buoy. And maybe you went to swimming classes, so you know you're a strong swimmer and can save the child. Let's imagine that you are stable mentally. You came from a solid, functioning background. Your mother wasn't alcoholic during her pregnancy with you. Your brain is properly formed, and you're able to think clearly about the best method with which to save the child. On the other hand, you were sick during the class that taught you about currents in rivers, so you don't fully comprehend that in this particular point of the river, the currents are very strong. So your chances of surviving and the child's are better if you enter the water a few yards down. See how many chance items affect every decision on your actions? I mean, you could throw in the life buoy at 2:35 p.m., just when an unpredictable gust of wind, what we call an act of God, carried it away from the child so he or she couldn't grab it. You could throw it in 1 second later and it'll land exactly in his or her arms. But setting aside all those chance events from the past and the present and a possible future, you still have a choice regarding which options you take at this present time. In my teacher's paper, he calls these paths 1, 2, and 3. And I'll describe them each after providing one more example. A reminder here that you're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Okay, here's a little story to be used as an example of the basis for how we select our own personal path in the world from the different paths open to us. Let's take the case of twins, identical twins, separated at birth. Their mother died in childbirth, so Nurse Betty tossed a coin. Heads meant one of the twins, Lucy, went with one family, tails with another. Lucy got heads and went to live with the Luck family. Fiona got tails and went to live with the Fortune family. One day it happens on their 16th birthday that they're both celebrating in the same restaurant, and they see their doppelganger across a crowded room. They rush up to each other and find out that they were both homeschooled, they both lived in small, isolated communities, and that they have a ton of things in common. But some things they understand differently. Lucy's family told her that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, so that's what she believes. Fiona's family taught her that the Earth was created about 4.5 billion years ago. Big difference. So that's what Fiona believes. Lucy's taught to expect that she should do things for her own maximum pleasure. Fiona has been taught to treat others as she'd like to be treated herself. But in other areas, They're quite similar in personality. The thing is, their entire upbringing was decided on the toss of a coin by Nurse Betty. So if each twin decides to continue on the same path they're currently on, they're implicitly leaving everything, their decisions, their acts, and the rest of their lives to chance. This my teacher refers to as taking path two. An alternative would be to take path one. Path one involves striving to reduce, as far as possible, the extent to which one or both of these individuals is going to leave things to chance. Lucy has to ask herself the question, why do I think the Earth is 6,000 years old when Fiona and her parents are saying it's 4.5 billion years old? So beginning to contemplate that and other things she's learnt growing up means she's embarking on path one. She's not shrugging off complexities and often conflicting information, but digging deep to get as close as possible to the truth, to facts, to reality. Does it really matter whether any of us thinks the world is 6,000 years old or 4.5 billion years old? Well, it sort of does, if we're trying to understand the world and our place within it and improve both those things. Having facts to hand, being well versed in history and science and maths and the humanities, is the optimum way to conduct our lives, surely. There's that expression, happy pig, unhappy Socrates. The exact quote comes from John Stuart Mill, a major proponent of Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism philosophy I described earlier, is, it is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig are of a different opinion, it's because they only know their own side of the question. So we each of us has to decide, do we want to be happy pig or unhappy Socrates? If happiness is your ultimate goal, then your worldview might be to make yourself happy. And you can make all your decisions and conduct all your actions based on that. But it's a rather self-centered worldview to adopt if you think that your personal happiness doesn't necessarily make the biggest and best contribution you can make to the world. I'm still, if you'll agree with me, promoting the idea that attempting to make the world a better and more beautiful place for all is the sine qua non, but let's address path three. If path one was striving to reduce as far as possible what you leave to chance, and path two was simply accepting your current circumstances as a result of what you've been ingrained with in your past and just buying into the hand chance dealt you, then path three has you continuing to cede everything to chance, i.e. your future, as well as your present circumstances, that, of course, have been coloured by the past. That's going to mean that every decision you make and action you take is random. You're going to leave everything to chance. Whether you're going to make yourself healthier or talk to strangers or eat better or save that drowning child by whatever method or not bother. It doesn't really get you very far. But in fairness, here's the thing. You don't always know what you don't know. You don't always know that there's something new or better to be learned. And you don't always know if you're going to succeed in learning it, even if you do discover it and work hard to absorb it. You're still not going to be scoring aces all the time or judging water currents. You're going to consistently fail before you ever have a chance to succeed. And so it is with ethics and adopting a life philosophy and worldview that is a definitively moral one. In other words, choosing an ethical path one where you aim to leave no ethical decision to chance. And your categoric aim is to adopt a worldview that reflects that ethical stance. And by so doing, become the person you want to be. Because presumably the person you want to be is the best kind of person, not the worst. And arguably the best kind of person you can be contributes something valuable and morally beautiful to the world and commands respect from others and for yourself. ¶¶ The philosopher John McDowell says, occasion by occasion, one knows what to do, if one does, not by applying universal principles, but by being a certain kind of person, one who sees situations in a certain distinctive way. Becoming a certain kind of person is the topic of my Share an Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Bringing you some words of wisdom gleaned from a philosophy course I took at Oxford University this summer. You can think of this as part two of the Philosophy of Love show I did very recently, which also delved into what I learned from that course. It's funny, you take a course in philosophy and you do start to see things in more philosophical terms rather than just your more practical, everyday getting through life kind of terms. I was watching the sunset last night and the sky turned pink and orange and yellow and the clouds went from white to pink to black in the sky. It was the most incredible sunset. So beautiful. And it made me wonder why we're here at all, us humans, just to muck up the beauty of the world. And I think we're probably just here as observers, as maybe the only creature who could appreciate the world's beauty. Creature with an aesthetic sense was needed. And maybe that's our main purpose here, just to observe the existing beauty and contribute to it in whatever small way we can. You know, we're such a tiny element as individuals. We just form such a tiny element of all this. And not a very useful one, really, that I can think of. So maybe that's our duty, to be the observers and, as much as possible, the contributors to that beauty. Anyway, those were my thoughts. I thought I'd share them with you on this, my Share an Hour on Laguna's KX935. That's with me, Sharon James. If you want to listen to the show again, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without G, hour with the H. You can also listen on iTunes. But do check out our website for an exciting concert we have coming up with a very top rock star. And don't forget to tune in on air to the Share an Hour every Sunday night at 6 for more topics, interviews, thoughts, conversation. Given our topic today and the work you have ahead of you, I'm just going to leave you with this from the inimitable Randy Newman.
Karl Marx was a boy. He took a hard look around. He saw people were starving all over the place while others were painting the town. A public-spirited boy became a public-spirited man. So he worked very hard and he read everything. Till he came up with a plan. There'd be no exploitation, the worker or his kin. No discrimination, 'cause the color of your skin. No more private property, it would not be allowed. No one could rise too high, no one could sink too low, or go under completely like some we all know. If Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. And if I had him here in my mansion on the hill, I'd tell him a story, 'twould give his old heart a chill. It's something that happened to me. I'd say, Carl, I recently stumbled into a new family, with two little children in school, where all little children should be. I went to the orientation. All the young mommies were there. Carl, you never have seen such a glorious sight as these beautiful women arrayed for the night, just like countesses, empresses, movie stars, and queens. They'd come there with men much like me, froggish men, unpleasant to see. Were you to kiss one, Carl? Nary a prince would there be. Oh, Carl, the world isn't fair. It isn't and never will be. They tried out your plan, it brought misery instead. You see how they worked, be glad you were dead. Just like I'm glad I'm living in the land of the free, where the rich just get rich. because we care that the world still isn't fair.